from the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Charlie Rosen has written a bookshelf full of sports books. His latest is the superb Bullpen Diaries, Mariano Rivera, Bronx Dreams, Pinstripe Legends, and the Future of the New York Yankees. Charlie Rosen, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, as we speak, we're recording this on an evening in May 2011, in which the Yankees are involved in a late-inning close game with Baltimore. So thanks for going away from your game. And you probably have it on in the background there.
Okay. No, actually, if I was watching anything, I'd watch the basketball game, to tell you the truth.
Well, don't
tell anybody.
No one's listening. Let's talk a little baseball, then I'll talk basketball with you, too. In the past, pitchers almost always pitched complete games. Why did that change?
Well, I mean, in the past, there was one pitcher. It depends on how far back you want to go.
One guy
pitched every inning in the 1870s or so, just pitched every inning of every game, and that's the way it was. But as the game got a little more refined, they started using two pitchers, and pitchers would frequently pitch doubleheaders. But the game kept on getting more and more refined. Hitters, when the live ball came in, hitters were more dangerous. There were more runs scored. There were more pitchers. You never saw relievers. Our pitchers would pitch 26-inning ball games, would throw 200 pitches. Nobody paid much mind to it. But eventually they started using two pitchers and then three pitchers and then four pitchers just because of the increased runs that were scored. The season was also expanded. They used to play, early in the late in the 19th century. They the National League played like 112 games, and now they play 162 games. So the more games that were played, the more pitchers you needed. But still, relief pitchers weren't really worth anything. The guys in the bullpen were usually old veterans who were drinking buddies with the manager, or rookies who were getting their feet wet. And starters would also relieve. So the bullpen was not really important until around the 1920s. When there began to be more of a focus on relief pitchers, but only in an emergency, only if a guy was just getting clobbered. And it was, a game was 15 to nothing, you bring somebody in. But games like 15 to 12 or something, both pitchers would pitch complete games.
Well, so when did they start, when did the relief pitcher become like an everyday thing?
An everyday thing, huh?
Well, it's practically an everyday. Is it not an everyday
Now thing? It is, yeah. I mean, there was Johnny Murphy in the 30s with the Yankees. There was Joe Page in the late 40s. But they would come in and pitch three innings, four innings if they had to. But again, with travel and with hitters becoming with the technology, hitters could watch videos, and which meant that pitchers had to throw with more, starting pitchers had to use more effort just to get by the six innings, seven innings. And it was, I guess in the 50s, maybe, in the middle 50s, one of the people I interviewed for the book was Bob Feller, mm-hmm. the late Bob Feller.
Yeah.
And he said he used to pitch 340 innings a year, and he was a strikeout pitcher. He used to strike out over 300 hitters, which means that he's making more pitches per game. And he said he's to throw 130 pitches, 140 pitches, and pitch every 4 days and just not even think about it. Never hurt his arm. The only time he hurt himself was when he slipped on a muddy mound one day. It's the only time he was ever hurt.
You know, we are all constantly hearing about the pitch count now. That's like a stat. But that didn't used to, we didn't used to hear about that. And when did they start counting how many pitches the guy threw?
Well, it was Billy Martin who really created that situation when he coached the Oakland A's, and I can never remember years, in the 60s, mid-60s?
70s even, I think it was.
Yeah, maybe the 70s, and he had like these young pitchers, and he just would, they would just pitch and pitch, and 120 innings, 120 pitches, 130 pitches, and just pitch him and pitch him and pitch him. And 2 years later, almost all of them were couldn't scratch their noses without screaming in pain. They just, their arms just kind of blew out. And that was a big red flag for everybody. You can't, and especially as salaries climbed and salaries climbed, you're paying a guy $3 million, $4 million, you can't take the chance that he's going to blow his arm out. So it's kind of to protect the pitcher, but Bob Feller says it's really not good because young kids don't learn how to pitch. They're not allowed to pitch deep into ball games. They're not allowed to pitch out of trouble. So and a lot of pitches they mount them up on the scoreboard now, how many pitches pitch is throwing, and they look up and they see 100 pitches and they're like, okay, get me out of here, I'm ready to take a shower. So yeah, it's a whole new thing, but part of that is that the bullpen structure has changed. There are so many specialists now. There are long relief pitchers. There are left-handed relief pitchers. There's a seventh-inning pitcher, an eighth-inning pitcher, a closer. You just have the chance to keep on, a manager has a chance of keep on throwing in fresh pitchers. Give the hitters a new look. You face the same pitcher three times, four times in a game, and you can really zero in on what this guy has on any particular given night and what he's going to throw at this count and how he's going to try and get you out. And you see that the statistics that they keep these days, batting averages really shoot up for most pitchers, almost every pitcher, the second time around, through the lineup, the third time around, the fourth time around, they get higher and higher and higher with it as the lineup gets cycled. So by bringing in new pitchers, you kind of break that. Now you kind of have to start all over. What happened the first two or three at-bats for any given hitter doesn't mean anything anymore. Here comes a new guy, and then then here comes a new guy. So it's and it's always a fresh arm, and they don't get tired. And it's also because the games seem to have more meaning now. There's just more money on the line. There's a wild card, so more teams can get into the postseason, and the financial rewards are greater. So it seems as though there's more emphasis on each game. And you see managers managing each game as though it's the seventh game in the World Series.
We're talking with sports writer Charlie Rosen. Now, does that make baseball a little bit more like basketball? I mean, some people, some people think that you only have to watch the last 2 minutes of basketball. I think that is true of the Kentucky Derby. You only need to watch the last 2 minutes of it. But,
I disagree with that. In a basketball game,
yeah.
What happens in the last 2 minutes is a function of what's happened in the first 46 minutes, as far as what matchups are favorable to either one team or the other team, what's been working, what the officials are calling, what defenses, what adjustments one team has made, what adjustments another team has failed to make. It's like are coming in at the top of the ninth inning of a double perfect game in baseball and thinking that you haven't missed anything. It just doesn't.
I understand.
Doesn't work.
Yeah. So let's talk about Mariano Rivera for a minute in the context of the stuff you were just talking about. Do you think, you know, you say he's the greatest relief pitcher ever. Do you think he would have been a successful pitcher in an earlier era? Could he have pitched complete games?
Well, one of his last starts in the minor leagues before the Yankees called him up a million years ago, he pitched a no-hitter.
A complete game then.
A complete game no-hitter. He was a starting pitcher, and in his first time he came up with the Yankees, he came up as a starting pitcher. But he only had one pitch. And there's a whole difference between starting pitchers and relief pitchers in a lot of different ways. One of the people I spoke to was Tom House, who was an outstanding left-handed relief pitcher in the American League for many years, and who's now the pitching coach at USC. And he has a doctorate in psychology. And he says that there's an emotional personality difference between starters and relievers. Relievers are fidgety, nervous, action guys. If they had to sit around and pitch once every 5 days, they go crazy. They have to, they can't pace themselves. Starting pitchers have to have a game plan. They have to pace themselves. Okay, I'm going to start off throwing this guy a curveball the first time I see him. The second time I see him, I'm going to throw him a fastball and plan ahead. Relief pitchers can't do that. They just have to come out firing, give it their all. They have no room to pace themselves, to do anything like that. Which is leads to the Yankees making a big mistake with Jarrett Chamberlain a couple of years ago when they put him in the starting rotation. He just doesn't have that mentality. He's one of the pitchers I interviewed, one of the Yankees relievers I interviewed for the book. He says if he pitches 2 days in a row, the next day he's out early running the grandstand in the ballpark. He just can't. He can't be inactive. So that's, you know, that's part of it. Relief pitchers usually have one super duper pitch, and the major league ball clubs have a grading system. For some reason, it goes from 20 to 80. Why it doesn't go from 0 to 100? Nobody seems to know. I spoke to dozens of scouts, old time guys, pitching coaches, and nobody knows why it's so. But it's 20 to 80. 50 being average for a major league, 80 being the best possible. And they'll grade each pitch that a pitcher throws. So if a guy has a fastball, they'll give it a grade for velocity. They'll give it a grade for command, which is control within the strike zone. They'll give it a grade for movement, and they'll give it a grade for delivery. Does he make the same delivery with that pitch as he does with another pitch? And Mariano Rivera gets an 80 for his cut fastball. The best possible. It could not possibly be better. He gets an 80 for his location. He gets an 80 for his for the movement on that pitch. And he gets an 80 for his delivery. And I think the last part, the delivery, is the key to his success, among the keys to success, but is certainly the key to his longevity. Every pitch is the same. He doesn't grunt and groan like Chamberlain does. When he throws the ball, everything's flying all over the place. His mechanics are terrible, and he's really got to hump it up. You can see him struggling when he throws. Same thing with Phil Hughes. He loses. There's no smoothness. There's no ease in his motion. But Mariano pitches with total ease. It's amazing how the ball just explodes out of his hand. When he was younger, he used to throw 95, 96. This year, actually, he's thrown a little harder than he did last year. He's throwing like 92, 91, 92. Last year, he's throwing 89, 90. But his pitch is not moving as much. It's not dropping as much. It doesn't have as much depth, his cutter. But he's changed. He's adjusted by throwing his two-seam fastball more, which sinks and breaks into a right-handed hitter. So he used to throw maybe two-seamers 10% of the time. Now he's throwing it 20% of the time. And he has lost a little bit. I've spoken to scouts this year, and they rate his cutter now as only a 70, which is still incredibly good, but not the best ever.
He's in his early 80s now, right?
Right.
How old is
he? He's approaching his uniform number, 42.
42. So, I mean, that's pretty old for a ball player.
It is, but certain guys, there's a guy named Jack McMahon who was throwing 96, 97, 98 miles an hour in his middle 40s. Hoyt Wilhelm, of course, could have thrown forever. Knuckleballs are different. Satchel Paige, who knows how old he was when he was pitching in the major leagues. He always said, if you didn't know how old you were, how old would you be? and he was, I mean, I saw him when I was a kid, and he was still throwing hard. He had to be at least 50. So some guys, it's just a freak of their physiological freaks, and they can do it, and other guys can't. But I think his delivery, Mariano's delivery helps because there's a minimum strain on his body parts. And throwing a baseball is not something that the body is meant to do. There's such a strain on the shoulder and the elbow, particularly the elbow. But his mechanics are so good that it really minimizes all that stress.
We're talking with sports writer Charlie Rosen. His new book is a day-by-day diary of the 2010 Yankees season, bullpen diaries. How does a pitcher, this is the thing that kind of fascinates me, how does the pitcher come back from an outing in which he gets shelled or lets a championship get away from him? I remember Atlee Hammaker out here with the Giants, and he really suffered after he gave up 7 runs in the 1983 All-Star game, which included the first Grand Slam in All-Star game history, and then he never pitched well again after that. Now, Mariano blew a World Series. How does he come back from something like that?
Well, he blew the World Series under extenuating circumstances. The grass was wet. There was a bunt that he couldn't feel. He couldn't throw right. The winning base hit was a broken bat blooper. You know, certain things. You know, a guy can hit a 500-mile-an-hour line drive right at somebody and duck out of the way, and the ball hits his bat and just bloops to the outfield. So there's just so many variables. I wouldn't say he blew it. He made the pitches he had to make, and just circumstances weren't with him. One of the things that characterizes a good reliever, one of the qualities that a relief pitcher has to have, is a short memory. Every game is different. You have a bad game. Somebody said it's like you have a mouthful of vinegar. You spit it out, and you start all over again. It's a necessary quality to survive in the major leagues. In a bullpen, it's a little easier because you may be pitching the day after or skip one day and pitch. But if you're a starting pitcher, you have to brood about a bad outing for 4 days before you take to the mound again. Pitching coaches, you know, they look at videos, and here's a video of a game that you pitched 2 years ago where you pitched a shutout. Compare this with this video, and the coaching is much better. The tweaks that can be made in a pitcher's delivery that can be found, that can be located, which are meaningful, more easily come by. So if a guy is going to hang on to losses like that, then he doesn't really have the mentality to have a long career, you know, to be successful over a period of years.
Well, obviously you're a Yankee fan since you spent so much time with them, I would assume that you love the Yankees. And you really encounter fans who say, "I hate the Indians," or "I hate the Orioles," but you find all sports fans all over the country who say, "I hate the Yankees." Why do you think the Yankees engender such feelings, such strong feelings?
Because they win too much in the past.
Yeah.
It's like Phil Jackson, you know, who's a longtime friend of mine. When he first started winning championships in Chicago, oh, he's a great coach and he's wonderful and everybody likes him. Yeah. As he kept winning more and more and more, people started turning against him. It happened in LA also. He was the savior when he first got there, but then they kept on winning and winning. Oh, what does he do? He sits on the bench. He doesn't do anything. He's passive, blah, blah, blah. You win too much, and people get upset. You know, part of the book is my adventures as a Yankee fan, a tryout I had at the Yankee Stadium where I almost killed somebody, playing basketball when I was 10 years old with Phil Rizzuto and Yogi Berra. Actually, getting Joe DiMaggio to answer a question, which he without charging me anything, and playing punch ball in the streets of the Bronx, which was like an urban equivalent of baseball. They're just all over the place. They're in New York, which is still the media capital of the world, so. They've had very controversial figures in recent memory: Billy Martin, Reggie Jackson, George Steinbrenner. Steinbrenner made a lot of enemies. You know, my attitude is to try and forget everything that happens off the field. That's superfluous. The only thing that counts is what happens on the field, the game itself. It's non-scripted drama, in which the participants get a chance to really show what they're made of, grace under pressure or choking under pressure. And by following a team the whole year, you can really see how this plays out. You know, you can't watch a baseball game. You have to watch a baseball season. You can watch a basketball game, or you can watch a football game, but in baseball, to really understand what's going on, you have to watch a whole season.
Well, Charlie Rosen, as a writer, and I know you've written a lot about basketball. You've written 15 or something books on basketball. But I think if you were to look in the bookshelves, in places that still have bookshelves, you would find that there are more books about baseball than any other sport. Do you think baseball is a more intellectual sport in some way?
I don't think so. I think one of the differences is the pace of the game. You watch a baseball game, if you put a stopwatch on the actual time that there is action, that the ball is live, it'll be 4 or 5 minutes.
Out of a 4-hour game.
Out of a 4-hour game, which leaves a lot of time for play-by-play guys and color guys to talk. They have to fill in all this talk. And they analyze and super analyze and talk anecdotes, and this guy did this 50 years ago, and this and this and this and this. So there's a sense of history with baseball. Basketball, there's no time to talk. The game, bang, 48-minute game, there's 48 minutes of action. There are free throws, yes. There are timeouts, yes. Those are all commercials. Free throws, you know, so you have 60 seconds to say something. So you really can't get involved in anything deep. So basketball is really misunderstood because it's not explained enough. You can't, if there's runners on first and third and one out, the announcers have plenty of time to talk about strategy and about what might be expected, a double steal, a hit and run, whatever. They have plenty of time to talk about. Basketball, you don't. It's bang, 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 bang. You can talk over the action, but then you'll miss something.
Well, is there as, I mean, there are so many ways, for instance, that a runner can get to first base, as just an example of how complex baseball is. Is basketball equally as complex as baseball?
Oh, absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of differences. Number one, basketball players have to make, most of the time, have to make decisions on the run. And, which is unlike baseball, unlike football. You can't just get together and figure it out and give each other a side, bang, you're going. Pro teams, college teams will have about four or five offensive sets. A pro team will have about 15 or 20 offensive sets with maybe five options on each set. And they'll have maybe 10 different kinds of defenses. And you've got to be, as a player, as a coach, you've got to pick the right number for to match the personnel that's on the court, on your team and on the other team, according to what the score is, how the game is going. You've got to pick the right number. And the players have to know what is expected of them. They have to execute. It's a very it is an intellectual game. It's like ballet with defense. You know, it's a graceful game. It's but it's a quick game. You don't have time really too often to catch your breath and think about things. I mean, they have instant replays and everything, but they just show on TV. But they just show sensational plays. They show dunks and all that kind of stuff. And in basketball, there's much more teamwork involved than in baseball. Baseball, you have teamwork on a double play, on a relay throw, stuff like that. And basketball is all teamwork. Even if a guy is going one on one, something else is happening. There are 10 players on the court and one ball. The other 9 players are not just standing around and watching the guy with the ball. They're doing something. And indeed, the secret to really understanding what goes on in a basketball game is to be aware of what those other guys are doing. When I coached in the CBA, I had to do a lot of scouting, and that was really the basis of my scouting. What's a guy doing when he doesn't have the ball in his hands? That's how you can determine whether a guy is a winner or a loser in basketball.
Well, we've been talking with Charlie Rosen, and he's written tons of sports books, but his latest book is called Bullpen Diaries, Mariano Rivera, Bronx Dreams, Pinstripe Legends, and the Future of the New York Yankees. It's a fantastic book that you should all read, and there's a website that goes with it, yeah?
Yeah, there is.
People should Google it.
I don't
it
know exactly
fun.
What it is. You know, bullpendiaries.com or something like that.
Well, Charlie Rosen, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, it's time to head for the turnstiles. That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program, and you'll join us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank Charlie Rosen for being my guest this week. His book is called Bullpen Diaries, Mariano Rivera, Bronx Dreams, Pinstripe Legends, and the Future of the New York Yankees. I also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Miss Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thank you all for listening. I'll see you next time. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro.